There is no anti-mimetics division. Part 1. The anti-mimetics division of the SCP Foundation is one devoted to researching and containing anti-memes, anomalies that erase themselves from all perception. It's a category of anomalies that I've looked at multiple times before, even doing a whole video on anti-mimetics. But this will be a series of tales that make up a single story about the division and its chief, Marion Wheeler. As you can imagine, it's going to get pretty weird. I'm going to be tackling this one more like an audiobook, reading most of the narration as is, and folding in the dialogue into the narration. I'll throw in a few editor's notes here and there, though. With that, let's take a look. We begin with an SCP article, although it's likely quite familiar for most SCP fans, but it's worth a refresher since it's pretty plot critical. It's SCP-055, a self-keeping secret, or anti-meme. Information about its physical appearance, nature, behavior, and origins is self-classifying. It is not indescribable or invisible, as individuals are perfectly capable of entering the container and observing it, taking mental or written notes, making sketches, taking photographs, and even making video recordings. An extensive log of such observations is even on file. However, any information about the object leaks out of a human mind soon after such an observation. Individuals tasked with sketching a copy of a photograph of it are unable to remember what the photograph looks like, as are researchers overseeing these tests. Security personnel who observe it via closed-circuit television cameras emerge after a full shift exhausted and effectively amnesiac about the events of the previous hours. A great deal of scientific data has been recorded from 55, but cannot be studied. At least one attempt has been made to destroy it, or possibly move it from containment at Site-19 to another site, meeting failure for reasons unknown. It's possible that 55 has killed many hundreds of personnel, but the Foundation wouldn't know it. One agent realizes that they do remember that it is an anti-meme, and that doesn't get wiped, so maybe they could try remembering what it isn't. In a test, a personnel member was able to exit and recall that the object isn't round, but nothing else. Personnel involved with studying it have reported moderate levels of disorientation and psychological trauma associated with cycles of repeated memory and forgetfulness of the object, but no long-term behavioral or health problems were observed, and psych assessments of survey personnel showed consistent reports of this distress fading over time. It's recommended that at least one staff member capable of remembering the existence of 55 is posted to each critical site. With that, we can begin the story proper. Chapter 1. We need to talk about 55. Can I smoke? This time the receptionist narrows her eyes at Marion and says no, she can't smoke anywhere on Site 200. Just because it's an administration building doesn't mean they don't have lungs, or labor law. Marion notices the exasperation on the young woman's face, and remarks that she's asked her this before, hasn't she? The receptionist replies that it's been twice in the last quarter hour, so she must really need a smoke. She's genuinely puzzled at the repeated question, and she's doing a bad job of concealing her puzzlement. Marion says that she thinks this is like Memento, and that she thinks Marion has no long-term memory, and if she stays in one place for too long, she forgets why she's there. The receptionist is only just old enough to remember that film, so she hesitantly says that she guesses. Marion smiles sympathetically and shakes her head. It's nothing so simple. Minutes pass. She toys obsessively with her lighter. She's turning 50 this year and slowly graying, well on her way out of petite towards little old lady. In her bag, her phone beeps because it's time for a pill, but she tells it to remind her later. There is a slight tremble in her fingers, but that's not age-based infirmity, that's just ordinary nerves. She's nervous because she's here to meet an O5, and O5s are scary. O5s never want to see you for a small thing. It's the end of the world, or nothing. Finally, 40 minutes late, the door to the inner office opens. Four or five high-ranked Foundationers spill out, carrying laptops or briefcases. As a group, they head straight past reception and out to cars which are waiting. Marion recognizes a few of the faces. The Site-19 site director, the head recruiter for Western Europe. None of them glance in her direction. Once they're gone, O58's assistant pokes his head around the door. He's 20-something, improbably youthful, like a teenager stuffed into one of his dad's business shirts. His haircut is barely regulation. In one hand, he holds a tablet computer showing his boss's day planner. It's packed. The man evidently does not sleep. The assistant tells Marion that she can come through now. The office door closes behind them with an unusually heavy mechanical clunk, as if the whole thing is part of a machine built into the office walls. While Marion takes the indicated chair and sets her bag down, the assistant turns and does some confusing additional things to the door, causing it to make several further strange noises. O5s have non-trivial privacy and security requirements. The office is spacious, but somehow contrives to be dark despite two big corners of window and broad daylight outside. The walls are all bookshelves and dark wood paneling, perfectly stylish, but a style from the 90s, a little worn and not yet old enough to be fashionable again. As for the fellow behind the desk, well, an O5 never looks like you imagine. Marion takes a deep breath and asks what the topic is, as she didn't get any agenda or subject. Looking to her right, she notices that the assistant, without saying anything or making any undue noise, has set his tablet down on a table, produced a gun, and aimed it at her head. Marion stops talking. She sits still in her chair for a little while, absorbing the change of pace, letting her heart rate rise to a hummingbird's and then start to flatten again. She licks her lips and grips the armrests, otherwise staying perfectly still, waiting for another prompt. The assistant's face is totally neutral now, like this is just how meetings go. Maybe it is, for people up here. O58 finally speaks, asking her who she is. Marion blinks, and then says, "Oh God." O58 rephrases, reading off her personnel information. Marion Wheeler, 49, with loving husband and two boys in tow. Likes camping, hiking, and ornithology. Boring mother with perfect, airtight background in financials, as far back as they can examine. And she has full Foundation credentials, which they've never issued, including access to a list of installations and rooms, some of which don't exist, or were torn down decades ago. At least one hasn't been built yet she's got the front door key to it. That's before they get to her SCP access control lists, which he can only term as egregious. So she's a spy, and her objectives are misaligned with theirs, and Clay wanted to cut an MTF loose on her, but he was able to bring him around. He talked him into a face-to-face, as he thought there was a slim chance that if they locked her in a bomb-proof room and asked politely, she'd have the good sense to spare herself the rest. Marion has long since stopped listening, and now calls him a dullard, stating that she's his chief of anti-mimetics. Clay just replies that they don't have an anti-mimetics division, but Marion insists that they do. O58 says that they have a mimetics division, a telecontainment division, fire services, Ops A, Ops B, personnel, D personnel, and two dozen others, but they don't have an anti-mimetics division. Marion asks if they have an irony division, and then asks why they think the anti-mimetics division wouldn't show up in the listing. Clay doesn't take his eyes off of her, and says to O58 that this is just a cover story. A good one, but she's had it worked out in advance. The O5 tells him to lose the gun, and he grudgingly does so. Marion relaxes fractionally and explains that there are SCPs with dangerous memetic properties. There are contagious concepts which require containment just like any physical threat. They get inside your head and ride your mind to reach other minds. 058 agrees, as he could name a score of SCPs fitting this description without even thinking. Marion continues, saying that there are SCPs with anti-memetic properties. There are ideas which cannot be spread. There are entities and phenomena which harvest and consume information, particularly information about themselves. You take a Polaroid photo of one, it'll never develop. You write a description down with a pen on paper and hand it to someone, but what you've written turns out to be hieroglyphs, and nobody can understand them, not even you. You can look directly at one and it won't even be invisible, but you'll still perceive nothing there. Dreams you can't hold on to, and secrets you can never share, and lies and living conspiracies. It's a conceptual subculture of ideas consuming other ideas, and sometimes segments of reality. Sometimes people, which makes them a threat. That's all there is to it, really. Anti-memes are dangerous, and they don't understand them, therefore they are part of the problem. Hence, her division. They can do the sideways thinking that's needed to combat something which can literally eat their combat training. 058 stares back at her for a long moment, while Clay fidgets, disliking and distrusting the story. He tells Marion to name an anti-memetic SCP, so she mentions SCP-055, to which he retorts that there is no SCP-055. She argues, but he insists, as SCP numbers aren't assigned sequentially. There are gaps, and that number hasn't been assigned. It's not superstition, as they have enough to be concerned about without arbitrary numerological mysticism. They have SCP-666 and SCP-013, but there's no SCP-001, and there's no 055. 058 then tells him that he should look at this, and he turns his monitor. Clay bends over and reads it from top to bottom. Stunned, he scrolls back and reads it all a second time. 058 notes that the file's dated from 2008. It's got all the right flags and signatures. It's keyed and coded. It's real. Clay asks him if he's seen it before, but he never has, as far as he can remember anyway. On the other hand, if the content is accurate, both of them have probably seen it dozens of times. Clay glares at Marion, remarking that this isn't possible, and Marion nearly spits. She asks how long he's been working here. 058 just asks who wrote the file, how was the interview conducted, who is Bartholomew Hughes, and most importantly, how did Marion retain knowledge of any of this? Marion just says that Bart Hughes wrote the file, but he's dead now, and they don't want to know how. There's a very long pause while both of them react to this. In fact, they pass through a long, discrete sequence of reactions. Indignation at the seeming rudeness, confusion at Marion's incaution in front of sinister superiors, surprise at the magnitude of the claim, pure disbelief, comprehension, and finally horror. 058 carefully asks what would happen if they did know. Marion replies that it would happen to them as well. As for the rest of their questions, they manage that pharmaceutically. The Foundation has amnestics, for people who very badly need to forget things, but in anti-memetics, they have a different pill, for people who need to remember things that would otherwise be impossible to remember. Nestics, class W, X, Y, and Z. In her bag, her phone beeps again, and with a nod of approval from the 05, she turns her phone off and pulls out a blister pack of pills. They're hexagonal and green. She holds it up and is satisfied to see a flicker of recognition on 058's face. He's beginning to put it back together. She explains that these are Class W nestics, the weakest, suitable for continual use. 2 pills per day, and they can go down to the site pharmacy and ask. The pharmacist will claim that they don't stock any such things, but they're misremembering, so tell them to double check. 058 sighs and says that now he thinks he gets it, and can see why they're having this conversation at all. Marion pops out a 2nd pill and hands it over to him, telling him that this is because he missed a dose. He's supposed to be on these, the same as her and everybody on her staff. It's the only way they can work. He forgot to take a pill, and then he forgot all the information that the pills were helping him retain. He forgot why he was taking them, who gave them to him, and where to get more. He forgot about her and her entire department. And now she has to bring him up to speed. 058 asks if he takes this, he'll remember this whole conversation and they won't have to have it again. Marion just says, hopefully not, and Clay asks if he should be taking those. 058 just tells him that it's need to know, so maybe when he's an 05 himself. The two swallow their pills, and 058 asks what SCP-055 is. Marion relaxes and says that SCP-055 is nothing. As described in the file, it's a powerful information autosuppressor. As far as experimentation is uncovered, it can only be defined in negative terms. They can only record what it isn't. They know that it isn't safe or Euclid. They know that it isn't round or square or green or silver. They know it isn't stupid, and they know it isn't alone. What they do know is that it's weak, because it's the only antimimetic agent in their possession which has a physical entry in the files. They have paper records of the thing, and containment procedures. It's not safe, which means it's dangerous, but it's contained. 058 blinks and asks where they have procedures, and Marion just points to her head. He then asks how many other anti-memes are there, and how much more dangerous do they get. Marion replies that she knows of 10, but statistically there's probably at least 5 more that she doesn't know of. This doesn't count the anti-mimetic entities freely roaming the halls, not under containment. There are at least 2 in this room with them right now, but she tells them not to look, as it's pointless. 058 does an impressive job of controlling himself, keeping his attention focused on her. Clay doesn't fare so well, and quickly sweeps the whole room, even checking behind his back. He finds nothing, and looks baffled. She mentions that there's an invisible monster which follows her around and likes to eat her memories, but she's learned to manage with it. It's like a demanding pet. She produces tasty memories on purpose so it doesn't eat something important, like her passwords or how to make coffee. Clay asks what the other one is, and with another nod from 05, Marion goes to her bag again. This time, she pulls out a gun and shoots Clay twice in the heart. More aghast than in pain, Clay collapses sharply against the bookcase behind him. He pulls his head to face Marion and asks how she knew. She stands, aims more carefully, and shoots him again, this time in the head. 058, again, does an impressive job of not reacting, and remarks that that's Clay's gun, that she stole from him. She explains as she unloads it that it's tricky to steal a firearm this heavy from someone without them noticing, but it's a little easier to steal a firearm and then steal their memory of the theft. Like she said, a pet, and some pets are dumb enough that they can be trained. 058 replies that much he guessed, but why? Marion says that it's because he was supposed to be taking Class W Nestics, and you can't skip a dose. She's tried. You can postpone it, but you can't forget unless someone actively prevents you from taking it. There's only one person who could get close enough to him to do that, and that's his assistant. When she asked him how long he'd been working here, he didn't answer. The 05 thought she was being rhetorical, but he doesn't work here. He's an anti-meme. She asks him since when did he have an assistant, and tells him to look around this office. It's got one desk, and he's got a receptionist outside that screens his calls and schedules his meetings. Where would Clay even sit or fit? She tells him not to blame himself, as he's human, and these things are redaction incarnate. You need to think like a space alien to get around them. 058 asks if he's dead, which in any other workplace would be absurd. Marion replies, maybe. She can put his corpse in their research queue and they'll see what they can see when they open him up. There's a duality here, though. They're like parallel universes sharing the same space. It's conceptual versus concrete, figurative versus physical. It's very unusual for things to cross over, and she doesn't know what Clay was, but he had a human body, which instantly makes him weird, even by their standards. As ever, the search for stalemate continues. She'll let him know if they get any closer. 058 asks if there's any side effects of these pills, to which she just says nausea, dramatically increased risk of pancreatic cancer, and very bad dreams. Chapter 2. Introductory Antimimetics. Junior researcher Kim's been working for the Foundation for all of 4 hours, and he feels pulverized, as if an anvil were dropped on his head in that first introductory lecture. It's lunchtime, and he's found a corner so far back in the cafeteria that nobody bothers him, where he can chew and swallow non-anomalous food, drink apocalyptically strong coffee, and digest the hard lessons of the morning. On his Foundation-provided phone, he pages fretfully through the few SCP files for which he has clearance. Most of them have to be jokes. That's how they read. Like very bad, dark, frightening jokes. Kim's one of 11 junior researchers in the new intake, and the other 10 are sitting in a separate group at a separate table, chatting animatedly to one another. There are some instructors here and there, munching sandwiches. Other than them, the cafeteria, large enough to seat 200 people or more, is deserted. To Kim, that seems odd. Site 41 is large, 3 skulking buildings with significant basement space buried casually in the forests of central Colorado. Where is everybody? A man in a gray suit walks into the cafeteria, makes eye contact with Kim, and strides purposefully over. The man's suit is sharp enough to cut. He wears a tie pin and a platinum wristwatch as big as a brick. He looks badly misplaced. Site 41 is a working site. There's training, education, research, development, analysis, and even the containment of a very few safe SCPs going on here. Executives shouldn't ever be here. So what is he? A lost exec trying to find the helipad? Or a researcher or instructor dressing for the job he wants, not the job he has? He holds a handout and remarks that it's a hell of a first day, introducing himself as Alistair Gray. Kim introduces himself as Paul Kim, and Gray asks about his accent and where he's from. Kim blinks and says he's from New York, before asking if he's the site director. Gray just replies that he seems on edge, and Kim says that that figures, doesn't it? He must know how that intro goes. It's like an atom bomb to the ego. He just had almost everything he knows overturned, and it turns out that he spent his entire adult life being protected from dangerous knowledge, as if the whole outside world is a ball pit for under sevens. Stepping out of that has been humiliating to start with. He blinks again and asks Gray what he does here, as he didn't answer his question. Gray just responds that he didn't answer his. Kim begins to reply that of course he did, but then stops, his train of thought running off the end of the track into air. It's on the tip of his tongue, the answer to Gray's question, but he can't get the words out. That's weird, he remarks, shaking his head. He also notices at this point that Gray isn't wearing his badge. This could be an honest mistake, albeit an extremely serious one, but surely executives don't get to the executive level without being scrupulously correct in everything they do. Kim asks him again who he is, but Gray just replies that Kim's life story was fascinating. He spoke 4 languages, but only 1 now, and soon 0. Too huge an intellect to specialize, his education was a fusion of biochemistry and comparative literature. He felt as if he'd die if he couldn't find more foreign thoughts to cram into his head. He's been all over the world, hungry, and every country he's ever been to was like landing on another planet. He toys with anthropology, but there's too much world for one human race to ever understand, let alone one human. There's too much human race. They should pare it down. Kim nods and asks him to excuse him for a second. He then gets up and hurries to another table, to the instructor whom he met earlier that day. When he gets close to her, he feels a kind of staticky sensation building up. He tries to shake her shoulder and succeeds in moving it a little, but it's like reaching through tar. He shouts that there's a problem, an intruder, and it might be an SCP. She doesn't react. He tries the gaggle of fellow newcomers as well, but they keep chattering and hypothesizing, oblivious to him shouting and clapping in their ears. He looks back. Gray has stood up and started moving towards him, still with that confident smile. And there's definitely something wrong with him now, because he's visible through the tables, like an augmented reality hollow projection jammed inside Kim's eyeball. Kim realizes with a stab of fear that he can even see Gray when he blinks. His eyelids close, but Gray is still there, an apparition in what for all of Kim's life has been totally personal, private darkness. The only way he can avoid seeing Gray is to turn away, and even then he feels a radioactive prickling in the back of his eyeballs. Kim tries to phone one of the newbies, and the phone in their pocket rings, but other than that, nothing happens. Nobody reacts. He remarks that that doesn't make sense. Gray asks him if he remembers his father, but Kim edges away and says that he never knew his father. His mother raised him. Gray's white smile is a fixture. He says that these people loved Kim's perspective. They were going to put him to work on anomalous anti-memes, but they don't remember he exists. He doesn't exist. Kim says, mainly to himself, that there aren't any dangerous SCPs on this site, so either Gray is not dangerous or nobody knows he exists. If nobody knows he exists, then that means he's either brand new or... He trails off and asks what an anti-meme is. Gray just says hell of a first day again, and that Kim seems on edge. Kim bolts for the exit, turns a corner and runs 10 or 11 paces down the corridor to where there's an elevator. He stabs the down button and waits. The elevator door is highly polished, reflective. Kim catches sight of a face in the mirrored surface and nearly falls over with shock because it's a face he has never seen before, and it's apparently his own. Gray comes around the corner, still only strolling, just as the elevator cracks open. Kim dives in and punches the lowest floor, basement, at level 8. It's instinctive, although he could rationalize the decision in retrospect. He can't just get in his car and drive, as it's better if Gray stays on site than if he's set loose in rational reality. To do that, it's better if Kim retreats to the lowest, darkest corner of the site for which he has access, and then waits for Gray, and locks all the doors behind them, and waits to die. The elevator starts descending, and the apparition of Gray, visible through doors and floors, disappears upwards, shrinking with distance and perspective, but still smiling broadly down at Kim. He paces in the elevator. He doesn't remember what his face looks like. It said it had eaten all his secondary languages, but he doesn't remember learning anything other than English, so it's eating his memories. It's consuming information, and he can't contact anybody directly, which means he's on his own. He's not trained for this. He hammers his head once against the elevator wall and stares at his shoes. But he doesn't know that. What if he's been trained, but he doesn't remember his training anymore? What if he's been working here for years and he only thinks this is his first day? What if he's met this thing before? What if everybody on the site has met it multiple times and nobody remembers? Is this what an anti-meme is? Kim remembers the near-empty cafeteria and miles to totally unoccupied corridors and vacant offices and lab space. Maybe it's not just eating his memories. Maybe it eats people whole, removes them completely from history. Maybe it's been haunting this site for years, and that's why the site's so empty, because it's nearly finished exterminating them all. He needs to get help. He needs to warn somebody, but he can't talk to people. He can't phone them. He should write an SCP, but surely someone's already thought of that. He pulls his phone out and pulls out the listing. Nearly 10,000 SCP entries, with 100 of them tagged anti-memetics alone. He clears his mind and thinks. Gray, with an E, G-R-E-Y, 4739. He pulls up SCP-4739. Editor's note, this tale was written before an actual SCP-4739 was written, so the two don't line up, but perhaps that's somewhat expected given the circumstances. 4739 is a Keter class, and the containment procedures state that the writer is disregarding the format, because time is a factor. If you're reading this, you've already been isolated from the Foundation at large. Attempts to signal for help are futile. You are now inside 4739's gullet, after ingestion and prior to digestion. You need to get to lab S041B08053 as soon as possible and continue the research until you find a way to stop or kill Gray before it kills you. Don't read the rest until you're in the elevator. The elevator doors open at basement level 8, and Alistair Gray is waiting, still smiling disarmingly. He steps forward. Desperate, Kim hurls his phone overarm at the creature's forehead. It's a solid chunk of metal, and it's a dead hit. Gray reels backwards and cracks his skull against the wall. By the time he recovers, Kim is out of sight, tearing away down the left corridor, just echoing, fading footsteps on concrete. Two 45-degree turns, and room 53 is in sight, the door at the farthest end. It looks like a submarine bulkhead. He spots the keypad and tries 4739. It works, and the bulkhead mechanism takes agonizing seconds to open up. He hears Gray calling down the corridor, asking if he remembers his mother. Kim hisses under his breath that he never knew his parents. He was an orphan. For a split second, he wonders what Gray might really mean by that, but he doesn't have time to dwell on it. The bulkhead opens, and Kim slides in and pulls it closed behind him, locking the mechanism up again, as if that'll buy him even 1 second. The lab inside is sizable, windowless, of course, and stacked to the ceiling with a jumble of equipment which Kim hardly recognizes. There are pieces of thick, shattered glass underfoot, and in the corner, a locked computer terminal. Kim unlocks it, and there's the same entry waiting for him. SCP-4739 is a powerful, slow-acting, anti-memetic kill agent, taking the appearance of a male, Caucasian business executive calling itself Alistair Gray. It is attracted to dense clusters of organically stored information. Essentially, extremely knowledgeable, complicated, interesting people. It isolates its victim from the outside world by enveloping them in an anti-memetic field, which makes it impossible for the victim, or anything done by the victim, to be perceived or remembered. It then consumes the victim's memories and knowledge until they become vegetative and die. This process takes between 15 minutes and 2 hours, and is described as being like Alzheimer's disease in fast forward. It is not believed to be sentient, although it imitates the behavior of a sentient being to the extent that it can appear sentient to the inattentive. Its victims are able to move and act freely, since it is impossible to escape once caught or to signal for help. Communications such as written notes, graffiti, and electronic mail do get sent and persist in reality, but its effect spreads with each message, making it impossible for an external observer to perceive the message until such time as 4739 catches them too. The entry, which you are currently reading, is created and maintained by victims of 4739, because it is only visible to victims of 4739. If you are reading this entry, it has caught you. You are now isolated from the Foundation at large, and constitute an effective foundation of one. You have between 15 minutes and 2 hours to reach Site 41, Basement Level 8, Laboratory 053, familiarize yourself with the existing research, and continue this research until you find a way to contain or decommission 4739, or more likely, die. If your field of expertise is not related to antimimetic containment, they sincerely apologize and advise you to start learning fast. 4739 has consumed 79 Foundation researchers since they started counting on August 3rd, 2013. If you are reading this entry for the first time, please add a mark. They estimate at least 50% of victims never make it as far as this database entry, so the true victim count is more than twice this figure. Kim screams at the terminal, asking how he kills it. He scrolls and scrolls through the research, which is chaotic and haphazardly arranged, because nobody has found the spare seconds to sort it out. There are dozens of separate lines of research, contributed in patchwork by a succession of victims, all ending with variations on the same final line. I'm going to try X. If you're reading this, X didn't work, and I'm dead, which means approach X is a dead end, and you have to think of something else. Nobody has succeeded in physically engaging with Gray. Nobody can stall it, evade it, slow it down, reason with it, or redirect it to some other target. People have tried poisoning their memories with indigestible ideas, drip-feeding their memories to Gray to slow him down, replacing their memories faster than Gray can eat them, and force-feeding him too many memories at once to overfeed him and blow him up. They've tried committing suicide by Class A amnestic overdose. None of it worked. More than 100 people, most of them apparently possessing doctorates, have slid into the maw of this thing, fought briefly, and with a greater or lesser degree of dignity, died. There are no remaining untried threads. Kim concludes that he's screwed. He glances up. Gray's not in the room yet, but Kim can see him strolling down the last stretch of corridor. He's a totally intangible being. Physical obstructions are irrelevant to him. He can't be hurt. Kim clutches the pocket where he used to keep his phone. He scrolls again, finding 3 or 4 sad, desperate wretches who died confronting Gray physically. Combat knife and Glock, baseball bat, which is still in the room, rolled under a table. One man, an elderly botanist far out of his depth, said he was just going to try whatever he could find that was heaviest. That explains the shattered CRT television and the light layer of thick glass on the floor near the bulkhead. There's even CCTV footage of the botanist's attempt. He accomplishes literally nothing. Gray is a holographic ghost, and the CRT drops right through him, imploding when it hits the floor at Gray's feet. The botanist spends the rest of the video's running time huddled in a corner, gradually losing his mind while Gray watches placidly. The difference being, Kim realizes, a phone is a solid brick full of information. Before him, nobody tried using information as a missile. He searches for the experiments, several of them, scattered, where the victim tried to divert Gray to a different data source. The general idea seemed to be to overload Gray by pointing him at something containing too much information. The internet, or the terabit feed from a live particle accelerator experiment, or a stack of hard drives containing the first few quadrillion binary digits of pi. But nobody could figure out a way to distract Gray's attention. He would ignore prominently placed screens full of data. Data beamed at him electromagnetically had no effect. And nobody could figure out a way to tunnel the information in through the victim's mind as extra memories. It was written off as impossible, closed as a line of investigation. The hard drives, Kim finds, are right there on the workbench next to the computer. It's a half-rack unit, a cuboidal block of metalwork as big and heavy as a bowling ball. One of the most ineffective conceivable melee weapons. Kim snatches up the three longest pieces of Ethernet cables he can find and starts plating them into a chain. Then he remembers who he is, and where he is, and what his responsibilities are. He goes to the computer, adds himself to the victim tally, and writes up exactly what it is he's about to try. Because he might not be the last one, and the world needs to know that this didn't work. Gray comes through the lab bulkhead to find most of the equipment in the room toppled onto the floor to create room for the black and silver drive array that Paul Kim is whirling around his head on a 2-meter chain made of plated network cable. It makes a low thrumming sound as it whirls. Gray is not intelligent enough to stop moving forwards and catches the array directly in the side of his head, rack mount point first, like a morning star. Gray absorbs a few trillion digits of the impact, but it isn't enough. There's a green snap of light and a noise like a subway train short-circuiting, and Gray's a pile in the corner, his head caved in and the drive array partially demolished in pieces around him. Kim decides that history can fill in whatever quip it likes best. Editor's note, my vote is for... That sure took a bite out of him. In the aftermath, Marion tells him that it was chewing its way up the anti-memetics division hierarchy. It was only a matter of time until it bit down on somebody dangerous. She congratulates him on demonstrating a basic level of competence when it counted. Dozens of others couldn't. Kim still feels rattled, but the shock is dissipating, faster than he'd expected. Marion Wheeler, it turns out, is the anti-memetics division chief. She's Kim's new boss. Kim says that he wants to say it was dumb luck. He wants to say that he just threw his phone. It was instinct, it was muscle memory. It was his first day, and he got lucky as hell. He wants to say those things, but he's sitting here and turning those statements over, and none of them would be true. Marion waits expectantly and says nothing. She's not his new boss. She's just his boss. This isn't his first day at all. He's been working here for over a decade. He thinks he's been a professional anti-memetics researcher since at least the mid-2000s. It's just that the first thing Gray ate was his memories of everything past the first day. Marion replies that she sees very little luck in what happened today. Instinct and muscle memory are just deep forms of training. Like she said, a basic level of competency. An ability to piece your own life and all of your past knowledge back together, faster than nearly anybody else. This is what they try to drill into them, and sometimes, thankfully, it takes. Kim continues, saying that this isn't even the first time they've had this conversation. There have been other incidents, with other SCPs with amnestic powers. She sat there and watched him pull himself back together before. Marion admits that it hasn't gotten old, with something which might be approaching a smirk. He asks her how long it usually takes for him to recover, to which she says a few months, but if he wants the truth, people in this division are as competent on day one as they'll ever be. You come to the job firing on all cylinders, or not at all. The rest is just fine-tuning and chemistry. Kim replies that what she's actually saying is she doesn't care about his mental state, and she needs him back at work now. Marion nods, and says that she needs an updated SCP entry to begin with. He needs to nail down the model for Gray's predatory pattern and exactly how he defeated it. She wants him to work out what it did with the bodies. Incinerated, disintegrated, or just left them lying around the site in rotting, perceptually cloaked heaps. And she needs countermeasures for when it comes back. Kim asks about it not being dead, but then says that he thinks he knows this one. It's coming back to him. Ideas don't die. This story is only just beginning, but we have the groundwork. There are anomalies in the world that can hide from practically all perception, eating away at people, literally or metaphysically, until no one remembers them either. In a world filled with dangerous anomalies, the ones that go unnoticed are perhaps the most threatening, which is what makes the Anti-Mimetics Division so important. We'll find out more in part 2.